muscle with authority figures. Others are just the opposite. People who are rejection sensitive are warm and loving when they feel secure, hostile and controlling when they feel rejected. But this comfortable compromise raises a variation on the problem of free will that we explored in Chapter 5. We know that there are physiological limits on who we are and how we act. But should we attempt to manipulate our behavior within the range available to us? Or should we simply be true to ourselves? At what point does controlling our behavior become futile or exhausting? If you're an introvert in corporate America, should you try to save your true self for quiet weekends and spend your weekdays striving to get out there, mix, speak more often, and connect with your team and others, deploying all the energy and personality you can muster, as Jack Welch advised in a Business Week online column? If you're an extroverted university student, should you save your true self for rowdy weekends and spend your weekdays focusing and studying? Can people fine-tune their own personalities this way? The only good answer I've heard to these questions comes from Professor Brian Little. On the morning of October 12, 1979, Little visited the Royal Military College Saint-Jean on the Richelieu River, 40 kilometers south of Montreal, to address a group of senior military officers. As an introvert might be expected to do, he'd prepared thoroughly for the speech, not only rehearsing his remarks, but also making sure he could cite the latest research. Even while delivering his talk, he was in what he calls classic introvert mode, continually scanning the room for audience displeasure and making adjustments as needed, a statistical reference here, a dollop of humor there. The speech was a success, so much so that he would be invited to make it every year. But the next invitation the college extended horrified him: to join the top brass for lunch. Little had to deliver another lecture that afternoon, and he knew that making small talk for an hour and a half would wipe him out. He needed to recharge for his afternoon performance. Thinking quickly, he announced that he had a passion for ship design and asked his hosts if he might instead take the opportunity of his visit to admire the boats passing by on the Richelieu River. He then spent his lunch hour strolling up and down the river pathway with an appreciative expression on his face. For years, Little returned to lecture at the college, and for years, at lunchtime, he walked the banks of the Richelieu River, indulging his imaginary hobby, until the day the college moved its campus to a landlocked location. Stripped of his cover story, Professor Little resorted to the only escape hatch he could find, the men's room. After each lecture, he would race to the restroom and hide inside a stall. One time, a military man spotted Little's shoes under the door and began a hearty conversation. So Little took to keeping his feet propped up on the bathroom walls, where they would be hidden from view. Taking shelter in bathrooms is a surprisingly common phenomenon, as you probably know if you're an introvert. "After a talk, I'm in bathroom stall number 9, Little once told Peter Gazowski, one of Canada's most eminent talk show hosts. "After a show, I'm in stall number 8, replied Gazowski, not missing a beat. You might wonder how a strong introvert like Professor Little manages to speak in public so effectively. The answer, he says, is simple, and it has to do with a new field of psychology that he created almost single-handedly, called free trait theory. Little believes that fixed traits and free traits coexist. According to free trait theory, we are born and culturally endowed with certain personality traits, introversion, for example, but we can and do act out of character in the service of core personal projects. In other words, introverts are capable of acting like extroverts for the sake of work they consider important, people they love, or anything they value highly. Free trait theory explains why an introvert might throw his extroverted wife a surprise party or join the PTA at his daughter's school. It explains how it's possible for an extroverted scientist to behave with reserve in her laboratory, for an agreeable person to act hard-nosed during a business negotiation, and for a cantankerous uncle to treat his niece tenderly when he takes her out for ice cream. As these examples suggest, free trait theory applies in many different contexts. but it's especially relevant for introverts living under the extrovert ideal. According to Little, our lives are dramatically enhanced when we're involved in core personal projects that we consider meaningful, manageable, and not unduly stressful, and that are supported by others. When someone asks us, "How are things?" we may give a throwaway answer, but our true response is a function of how well our core personal projects are going. That's why Professor Little, the consummate introvert, lectures with such passion. Like a modern-day Socrates, he loves his students deeply. Opening their minds and attending to their well-being are two of his core personal projects. When Little held office hours at Harvard, the students lined up in the hallway as if he were giving out free tickets to a rock concert. For more than 20 years, his students asked him to write several hundred letters of recommendation a year. Brian Little is the most engaging, entertaining, and caring professor I have ever encountered, wrote one student about him. I cannot even begin to explain the myriad ways in which he has positively affected my life. So, for Brian Little, the additional effort required to stretch his natural boundaries is justified by seeing his core personal project, igniting all those minds, come to fruition. At first blush, free trait theory seems to run counter to a cherished piece of our cultural heritage. Shakespeare's oft-quoted advice, "To thine own self be true," runs deep in our philosophical DNA. Many of us are uncomfortable with the idea of taking on a false persona for any length of time. And if we act out of character by convincing ourselves that our pseudo-self is real, we can eventually burn out without even knowing why. The genius of Little's theory is how neatly it resolves this discomfort. Yes, we are only pretending to be extroverts. And yes, such inauthenticity can be morally ambiguous, not to mention exhausting. But if it's in the service of love or a professional calling, then we're doing just as Shakespeare advised. When people are skilled at adopting free traits, it can be hard to believe that they're acting out of character. Professor Little's students are usually incredulous when he claims to be an introvert. But Little is far from unique. Many people, especially those in leadership roles, engage in a certain level of pretend extroversion. Consider, for example, my friend Alex, the socially adept head of a financial services company, who agreed to give a candid interview on the condition of sealed-in-blood anonymity. Alex told me that pretend extroversion was something he taught himself in the 7th grade, when he decided that other kids were taking advantage of him. "I was the nicest person you'd ever want to know," Alex recalls, "but the world wasn't that way. The problem was that if you were just a nice person, you'd get crushed. I refused to live a life where people could do that stuff to me. I was like, okay, what's the policy prescription here? And there really was only one. I needed to have every person in my pocket. If I wanted to be a nice person, I needed to run the school. But how to get from A to B? I studied social dynamics. I guarantee more than anyone you've ever met," Alex told me. He observed the way people talked, the way they walked, especially male dominance poses. He adjusted his own persona, which allowed him to go on being a fundamentally shy, sweet kid, but without being taken advantage of. "Any hard thing where you can get crushed, I was like, I need to learn how to do this. So by now, I'm built for war, because then people don't screw you." Alex also took advantage of his natural strengths. "I learned that boys basically do only one thing. They chase girls. They get them, they lose them, they talk about them. I was like, that's completely circuitous. I really like girls. That's where intimacy comes from. So rather than sitting around and talking about girls, I got to know them. I used having relationships with girls, plus being good at sports, to have the guys in my pocket. Oh, and every once in a while, you have to punch people. I did that, too." Today, Alex has a folksy, affable, whistle-while-you-work demeanor. I've never seen him in a bad mood. But you'll see his self-taught, bellicose side if you ever try to cross him in a negotiation and you'll see his introverted self if you ever try to make dinner plans with him. I could literally go years without having any friends except for my wife and kids, he says. Look at you and me. You're one of my best friends. And how many times do we actually talk? When you call me. I don't like socializing. My dream is to live off the land on 1,000 acres with my family. You never see a team of friends in that dream. So notwithstanding whatever you might see in my public persona, I am an introvert. I think that fundamentally, I'm the same person I always was. Massively shy. But I compensate for it. But how many of us are really capable of acting out of character to this degree, putting aside for the moment the question of whether we want to? Professor Little happens to be a great performer, and so are many CEOs. What about the rest of us? Some years ago, a research psychologist named Richard Lippa set out to answer this question. He called a group of introverts to his lab and asked them to act like extroverts while pretending to teach a math class. Then he and his team, video cameras in hand, measured the length of their strides, the amount of eye contact they made with their students, the percentage of time they spent talking, the pace and volume of their speech, and the total length of each teaching session. They also rated how generally extroverted the subjects appeared, based on their recorded voices and body language. Then Lippa did the same thing with actual extroverts and compared the results. He found that although the latter group came across as more extroverted, some of the pseudo-extroverts were surprisingly convincing. It seems that most of us know how to fake it to some extent. Whether or not we're aware that the length of our strides and the amount of time we spend talking and smiling mark us as introverts and extroverts, we know it unconsciously. Still, there's a limit to how much we can control our self-presentation. This is partly because of a phenomenon called behavioral leakage, in which our true selves seep out via unconscious body language, a subtle look away at a moment when an extrovert would have made eye contact, or a skillful turn of the conversation by a lecturer that places the burden of talking on the audience when an extroverted speaker would have held the floor a little longer. How was it that some of Lippa's pseudo-extroverts came so close to the scores of true extroverts? It turned out that the introverts who were especially good at acting like extroverts tended to score high for a trait that psychologists call self-monitoring. Self-monitors are highly skilled at modifying their behavior to the social demands of a situation. They look for cues to tell them how to act. When in Rome, they do as the Romans do, according to the psychologist Mark Snyder, author of Public Appearances, Private Realities, and creator of the self-monitoring scale. One of the most effective self-monitors I've ever met is a man named Edgar, a well-known and much-beloved fixture on the New York social circuit. He and his wife host or attend fundraisers and other social events seemingly every weeknight. He's the kind of enfant terrible whose latest antics are a favorite topic of conversation. But Edgar is an avowed introvert. I'd much rather sit and read and think about things than talk to people, he says. Yet talk to people he does. Edgar was raised in a highly social family that expected him to self-monitor, and he's motivated to do so. I love politics, he says. I love policy. I love making things happen. I want to change the world in my own way. So I do stuff that's artificial. I don't really like being the guest at someone else's party, because then I have to be entertaining. But I'll host parties, because it puts you at the center of things without actually being a social person. When he does find himself at other people's parties, Edgar goes to great lengths to play his role. All through college, and recently even, before I ever went to a dinner or cocktail party, I would have an index card with 3 to 5 relevant, amusing anecdotes. I'd come up with them during the day. If something struck me, I'd jot it down. Then, at dinner, I'd wait for the right opening and launch in. Sometimes I'd have to go to the bathroom and pull out my cards to remember what my little stories were. Over time, though, Edgar stopped bringing index cards to dinner parties. He still considers himself an introvert, but he grew so deeply into his extroverted role that telling anecdotes started to come naturally to him. Indeed, the highest self-monitors tend not only to be good at producing the desired effect and emotion in a given social situation, they also experience less stress while doing so. In contrast to the Edgars of the world, low self-monitors base their behavior on their own internal compass. They have a smaller repertoire of social behaviors and masks at their disposal. They're less sensitive to situational cues, like how many anecdotes you're expected to share at a dinner party, and less interested in role-playing, even when they know what the cues are. It's as if low self-monitors, LSMs, and high self-monitors, HSMs, play to different audiences, Snyder has said, one inner, the other outer. If you want to know how strong a self-monitor you are, here are a few questions from Snyder's self-monitoring scale. When you're uncertain how to act in a social situation, do you look to the behavior of others for cues? Do you often seek the advice of your friends to choose movies, books, or music? In different situations and with different people, do you often act like very different people? Do you find it easy to imitate other people? Can you look someone in the eye and tell a lie with a straight face, if for a right end? Do you ever deceive people by being friendly when really you dislike them? Do you put on a show to impress or entertain people? Do you sometimes appear to others to be experiencing deeper emotions than you actually are? The more times you answered yes to these questions, the more of a high self-monitor you are. Now ask yourself these questions. Is your behavior usually an expression of your true inner feelings, attitudes, and beliefs? Do you find that you can only argue for ideas that you already believe? Would you refuse to change your opinions or the way you do things in order to please someone else or win their favor? Do you dislike games like charades or improvisational acting? Do you have trouble changing your behavior to suit different people and different situations? The more you tended to answer yes to this second set of questions, the more of a low self-monitor you are. When Professor Little introduced the concept of self-monitoring to his personality psychology classes, some students got very worked up about whether it was ethical to be a high self-monitor. A few mixed couples, HSMs and LSMs in love, even broke up over it, he was told. To high self-monitors, low self-monitors can seem rigid and socially awkward. To low self-monitors, high self-monitors can come across as conformist and deceptive, more pragmatic than principled, in Mark Snyder's words. Indeed, HSMs have been found to be better liars than LSMs, which would seem to support the moralistic stance taken by low self-monitors. But Little, an ethical and sympathetic man who happens to be an extremely high self-monitor, sees things differently. He views self-monitoring as an act of modesty. It's about accommodating oneself to situational norms rather than grinding down everything to one's own needs and concerns. Not all self-monitoring is based on acting, he says, or on working the room. A more introverted version may be less concerned with spotlight seeking and more with the avoidance of social faux pas. When Professor Little makes a great speech, it's partly because he's self-monitoring every moment, continually checking his audience for subtle signs of pleasure or boredom and adjusting his presentation to meet its needs. So if you can fake it, if you master the acting skills, the attention to social nuance, and the willingness to submit to social norms that self-monitoring requires, should you? The answer is that a free trait strategy can be effective when used judiciously, but disastrous if overdone. Recently, I spoke on a panel at Harvard Law School. The occasion was the 55th anniversary of women being admitted to the law school. Alumni from all over the country gathered on campus to celebrate. The subject of the panel was, in a different voice, strategies for powerful self-presentation. There were four speakers: a trial lawyer, a judge, a public speaking coach, and me. I'd prepared my remarks carefully. I knew the role I wanted to play. The public speaking coach went first. She talked about how to give a talk that knocks people's socks off. The judge, who happened to be Korean-American, spoke of how frustrating it is when people assume that all Asians are quiet and studious, when in fact she's outgoing and assertive. The litigator, who was petite and blonde and feisty as hell, talked about the time she conducted a cross-examination only to be admonished by a judge to back down, tiger. When my turn came, I aimed my remarks at the women in the audience who didn't see themselves as tigers, mythbusters, or sock-knocker offers. I said that the ability to negotiate is not inborn, like blonde hair or straight teeth, and it does not belong exclusively to the table-pounders of the world. Anyone can be a great negotiator, I told them, and in fact, it often pays to be quiet and gracious, to listen more than talk, and to have an instinct for harmony rather than conflict. With this style, you can take aggressive positions without inflaming your counterpart's ego, and by listening, you can learn what's truly motivating the person you're negotiating with and come up with creative solutions that satisfy both parties. I also shared some psychological tricks for feeling calm and secure during intimidating situations, such as paying attention to how your face and body arrange themselves when you're feeling genuinely confident and adopting those same positions when it comes time to fake it. Studies show that taking simple physical steps, like smiling, makes us feel stronger and happier, while frowning makes us feel worse. Naturally, when the panel was over and the audience members came around to chat with the panelists, it was the introverts and pseudo-extroverts who sought me out. Two of those women stand out in my mind. The first was Allison, a trial lawyer. Allison was slim and meticulously groomed, but her face was pale, pinched, and unhappy-looking. She'd been a litigator at the same corporate law firm for over a decade. Now she was applying for general counsel positions at various companies, which seemed a logical next step, except that her heart clearly wasn't in it. And sure enough, she hadn't gotten a single job offer. On the strength of her credentials, she was advancing to the final round of interviews, only to be weeded out at the last minute, and she knew why. Because the headhunter who'd coordinated her interviews gave the same feedback each time. She lacked the right personality for the job. Allison, a self-described introvert, looked pained as she related this damning judgment. The second alumna, Jillian, held a senior position at an environmental advocacy organization that she loved. Jillian came across as kind, cheerful, and down-to-earth. She was fortunate to spend much of her time researching and writing policy papers on topics she cared about. Sometimes, though, she had to chair meetings and make presentations. Although she felt deep satisfaction after these meetings, she didn't enjoy the spotlight and wanted my advice on staying cool when she felt scared. So what was the difference between Allison and Jillian? Both were pseudo-extroverts, and you might say that Allison was trying and failing where Jillian was succeeding. But Allison's problem was actually that she was acting out of character in the service of a project she didn't care about. She didn't love the law. She'd chosen to become a Wall Street litigator because it seemed to her that this was what powerful and successful lawyers did. So her pseudo-extroversion was not supported by deeper values. She was not telling herself, I'm doing this to advance work I care about deeply, and when the work is done, I'll settle back into my true self. Instead, her interior monologue was, the route to success is to be the sort of person I am not. This is not self-monitoring. It is self-negation. Where Jillian acts out of character for the sake of worthy tasks that temporarily require a different orientation, Allison believes that there is something fundamentally wrong with who she is. It's not always so easy, it turns out, to identify your core personal projects. And it can be especially tough for introverts who have spent so much of their lives conforming to extroverted norms that by the time they choose a career or a calling, it feels perfectly normal to ignore their own preferences. They may be uncomfortable in law school or nursing school or in the marketing department, but no more so than they were back in middle school or summer camp. I, too, was once in this position. I enjoyed practicing corporate law, and for a while I convinced myself that I was an attorney at heart. I badly wanted to believe it, since I had already invested years in law school and on-the-job training, and much about Wall Street law was alluring. My colleagues were intellectual, kind, and considerate, mostly. I made a good living. I had an office on the 42nd floor of a skyscraper with views of the Statue of Liberty. I enjoyed the idea that I could flourish in such a high-powered environment. And I was pretty good at asking the but and what if questions that are central to the thought processes of most lawyers. It took me almost a decade to understand that the law was never my personal project, not even close. Today I can tell you unhesitatingly what is. My husband and sons, writing, promoting the values of this book. Once I realized this, I had to make a change. I look back on my years as a Wall Street lawyer as time spent in a foreign country. It was absorbing, it was exciting, and I got to meet a lot of interesting people whom I never would have known otherwise. But I was always an expatriate. Having spent so much time navigating my own career transition and counseling others through theirs, I have found that there are three key steps to identifying your own core personal projects. First, think back to what you loved to do when you were a child. How did you answer the question of what you wanted to be when you grew up? The specific answer you gave may have been off the mark, but the underlying impulse was not. If you wanted to be a fireman, what did a fireman mean to you? A good man who rescued people in distress? A daredevil? Or the simple pleasure of operating a truck? If you wanted to be a dancer, was it because you got to wear a costume, or because you craved applause, or was it the pure joy of twirling around at lightning speed? You may have known more about who you were then than you do now. Second, pay attention to the work you gravitate to. At my law firm, I never once volunteered to take on an extra corporate legal assignment, but I did spend a lot of time doing pro bono work for a nonprofit women's leadership organization. I also sat on several law firm committees dedicated to mentoring, training, and personal development for young lawyers in the firm. Now, as you can probably tell from this book, I am not the committee type. But the goals of those committees lit me up, so that's what I did. Finally, pay attention to what you envy. Jealousy is an ugly emotion, but it tells the truth. You mostly envy those who have what you desire. I met my own envy after some of my former law school classmates got together and compared notes on alumni career tracks. They spoke with admiration, and yes, jealousy, of a classmate who argued regularly before the Supreme Court. At first I felt critical. More power to that classmate, I thought, congratulating myself on my magnanimity. Then I realized that my largesse came cheap, because I didn't aspire to argue a case before the Supreme Court or to any of the other accolades of lawyering. When I asked myself whom I did envy, the answer came back instantly. My college classmates who'd grown up to be writers or psychologists. Today I'm pursuing my own version of both those roles. But even if you're stretching yourself in the service of a core personal project, you don't want to act out of character too much or for too long. Remember those trips Professor Little made to the restroom in between speeches? Those hideout sessions tell us that, paradoxically, the best way to act out of character is to stay as true to yourself as you possibly can, starting by creating as many restorative niches as possible in your daily life. Restorative niche is Professor Little's term for the place you go when you want to return to your true self. It can be a physical place, like the path beside the Richelieu River, or a temporal one, like the quiet breaks you plan between sales calls. It can mean canceling your social plans on the weekend before a big meeting at work, practicing yoga or meditation, or choosing email over an in-person meeting. Even Victorian ladies, whose job effectively was to be available to friends and family, were expected to withdraw for a rest each afternoon. You choose a restorative niche when you close the door to your private office, if you're lucky enough to have one, in between meetings. You can even create a restorative niche during a meeting by carefully selecting where you sit and when and how you participate. In his memoir, In an Uncertain World, Robert Rubin, the Treasury Secretary under President Clinton, describes how he always liked to be away from the center, whether in the Oval Office or the Chief of Staff's office, where my regular seat became the foot of the table. That little bit of physical distance felt more comfortable to me and let me read the room and comment from a perspective ever so slightly removed. I didn't worry about being overlooked. No matter how far away you were sitting or standing, you could always just say, "Mr. President, I think this, that, or the other." We would all be better off if, before accepting a new job, we evaluated the presence or absence of restorative niches as carefully as we consider the family leave policy or health insurance plans. Introverts should ask themselves, will this job allow me to spend time on in-character activities like, for example, reading, strategizing, writing, and researching? Will I have a private workspace or be subject to the constant demands of an open office plan? If the job doesn't give me enough restorative niches, will I have enough free time on evenings and weekends to grant them to myself? Extroverts will want to look for restorative niches too. Does the job involve talking, traveling, and meeting new people? Is the office space stimulating enough? If the job isn't a perfect fit, are the hours flexible enough that I can blow off steam after work? Think through the job description carefully. One highly extroverted woman I interviewed was excited about a position as the community organizer for a parenting website, until she realized that she'd be sitting by herself behind a computer every day from 9 to 5. Sometimes people find restorative niches in professions where you'd least expect them. One of my former colleagues is a trial lawyer who spends most of her time in splendid solitude, researching and writing legal briefs. Because most of her cases settle, she goes to court rarely enough that she doesn't mind exercising her pseudo-extroversion skills when she has to. An introverted administrative assistant I interviewed parlayed her office experience into a work-from-home internet business that serves as a clearinghouse and coaching service for virtual assistants. And in the next chapter, we'll meet a superstar salesman who broke his company's sales records year after year by insisting on staying true to his introverted self. All three of these people have taken decidedly extroverted fields and reinvented them in their own image, so that they're acting in character most of the time, effectively turning their workdays into one giant restorative niche. Finding restorative niches isn't always easy. You might want to read quietly by the fire on Saturday nights, but if your spouse wishes you'd spend those evenings out with her large circle of friends, then what? You might want to retreat to the oasis of your private office in between sales calls, but what if your company just switched over to an open office plan? If you plan to exercise free traits, you'll need the help of friends, family, and colleagues. Which is why Professor Little calls with great passion for each of us to enter into a free trait agreement. This is the final piece of free trait theory. A free trait agreement acknowledges that we'll each act out of character some of the time, in exchange for being ourselves the rest of the time. It's a free trait agreement when a wife who wants to go out every Saturday night and a husband who wants to relax by the fire work out a schedule. Half the time we'll go out, and half the time we'll stay home. It's a free trade agreement when you attend your extroverted best friend's wedding shower, engagement celebration, and bachelorette party. But she understands when you skip out on the 3 days' worth of group activities leading up to the wedding itself. It's often possible to negotiate free trade agreements with friends and lovers whom you want to please and who love your true, in-character self. Your work life is a little trickier, since most businesses still don't think in these terms. For now, you may have to proceed indirectly. Career counselor Shoya Zishi told me the story of one of her clients, an introverted financial analyst who worked in an environment where she was either presenting to clients or talking to colleagues who continually cycled in and out of her office. She was so burned out that she planned to quit her job, until Zishi suggested that she negotiate for downtime. Now, this woman worked for a Wall Street bank, not a culture conducive to a frank discussion about the needs of the highly introverted. So she carefully considered how to frame her request. She told her boss that the very nature of her work, strategic analysis, required quiet time in which to concentrate. Once she made her case empirically, it was easier to ask for what she needed psychologically, 2 days a week of working from home. Her boss said yes. But the person with whom you can best strike a free trade agreement after overcoming his or her resistance is yourself. Let's say you're single. You dislike the bar scene, but you crave intimacy, and you want to be in a long-term relationship in which you can share cozy evenings and long conversations with your partner and a small circle of friends. In order to achieve this goal, you make an agreement with yourself that you will push yourself to go to social events, because only in this way can you hope to meet a mate and reduce the number of gatherings you attend over the long term. But while you pursue this goal, you will attend only as many events as you can comfortably stand. You decide in advance what that amount is. Once a week, once a month, once a quarter. And once you've met your quota, you've earned the right to stay home without feeling guilty. Or perhaps you've always dreamed of building your own small company, working from home so you can spend more time with your spouse and children. You know you'll need to do a certain amount of networking, so you make the following free trade agreement with yourself. You will go to one schmoozefest per week. At each event, you will have at least one genuine conversation, since this comes easier to you than working the room, and follow up with that person the next day. After that, you get to go home and not feel bad when you turn down other networking opportunities that come your way. Professor Little knows all too well what happens when you lack a free trade agreement with yourself. Apart from occasional excursions to the Richelieu River or the restroom, he once followed a schedule that combined the most energy-zapping elements of both introversion and extroversion. On the extroverted side, his days consisted of nonstop lectures, meetings with students, monitoring a student discussion group, and writing all those letters of recommendation. On the introverted side, he took those responsibilities very, very seriously. "One way of looking at this," he says now, "is to say that I was heavily engaged in extrovert-like behaviors. But of course, had I been a real extrovert, I would have done quicker, less nuanced letters of recommendation, would not have invested the time in preparation of lectures, and the social events would not have drained me." He also suffered from a certain amount of what he calls reputational confusion, in which he became known for being over-the-top effervescent, and the reputation fed on itself. This was the persona that others knew, so it was the persona he felt obliged to serve up. Naturally, Professor Little started to burn out, not only mentally, but also physically. Never mind, he loved his students, he loved his field, he loved it all. Until the day that he ended up in the doctor's office with a case of double pneumonia that he'd been too busy to notice. His wife had dragged him there against his will, and a good thing, too. According to the doctors, if she had waited much longer, he would have died. Double pneumonia and an overscheduled life can happen to anyone, of course, but for Little, it was the result of acting out of character for too long and without enough restorative niches. When your conscientiousness impels you to take on more than you can handle, you begin to lose interest, even in tasks that normally engage you. You also risk your physical health. Emotional labor, which is the effort we make to control and change our own emotions, is associated with stress, burnout, and even physical symptoms like an increase in cardiovascular disease. Professor Little believes that prolonged acting out of character may also increase autonomic nervous system activity, which can, in turn, compromise immune functioning. One noteworthy study suggests that people who suppress negative emotions tend to leak those emotions later in unexpected ways. The psychologist Judith Grob asked people to hide their emotions as she showed them disgusting images. She even had them hold pens in their mouths to prevent them from frowning. She found that this group reported feeling less disgusted by the pictures than did those who'd been allowed to react naturally. Later, however, the people who hid their emotions suffered side effects. Their memory was impaired, and the negative emotions they'd suppressed seemed to color their outlook. When Grob had them fill in the missing letter to the word GR-SS, for example, they were more likely than others to offer gross rather than grass. People who tend to suppress their negative emotions regularly, concludes Grob, might start to see the world in a more negative light. That's why, these days, Professor Little is in restorative mode, retired from the university, and reveling in his wife's company in their house in the Canadian countryside. Little says that his wife, Sue Phillips, the director of the School of Public Policy and Administration at Carleton University, is so much like him that they don't need a free trade agreement to govern their relationship. But his free trade agreement with himself provides that he do his remaining scholarly and professional deeds with good grace, but not hang around longer than necessary. Then he goes home and snuggles by the fire with Sue. Chapter 10, The Communication Gap, How to Talk to Members of the Opposite Type. The meeting of two personalities is like the contact of two chemical substances. If there is any reaction, both are transformed. Carl Jung. If introverts and extroverts are the north and south of temperament, opposite ends of a single spectrum, then how can they possibly get along? Yet the two types are often drawn to each other in friendship, business, and especially romance. These pairs can enjoy great excitement and mutual admiration, a sense that each completes the other. One tends to listen, the other to talk. One is sensitive to beauty, but also to slings and arrows, while the other barrels cheerfully through his days. One pays the bills, and the other arranges the children's playdates. But it can also cause problems when members of these unions pull in opposite directions. Greg and Emily are an example of an introvert-extrovert couple who love and madden each other in equal measure. Greg, who just turned 30, has a bounding gait, a mop of dark hair continually falling over his eyes, and an easy laugh. Most people would describe him as gregarious. Emily, a mature 27, is as self-contained as Greg is expansive. Graceful and soft-spoken, she keeps her auburn hair tied in a chignon and often gazes at people from under lowered lashes. Greg and Emily complement each other beautifully. Without Greg, Emily might forget to leave the house, except to go to work. But without Emily, Greg would feel, paradoxically for such a social creature, alone. Before they met, most of Greg's girlfriends were extroverts. He says he enjoyed those relationships, but never got to know his girlfriends well because they were always plotting how to be with groups of people. He speaks of Emily with a kind of awe, as if she has access to a deeper state of being. He also describes her as the anchor around which his world revolves. Emily, for her part, treasures Greg's ebullient nature. He makes her feel happy and alive. She has always been attracted to extroverts who, she says, do all the work of making conversation. For them, it's not work at all. The trouble is that for most of the 5 years they've been together, Greg and Emily have been having one version or another of the same fight. Greg, a music promoter with a large circle of friends, wants to host dinner parties every Friday, casual, animated get-togethers with heaping bowls of pasta and flowing bottles of wine. He's been giving Friday night dinners since he was a senior in college, and they've become a highlight of his week and a treasured piece of his identity. Emily has come to dread these weekly events. a hard-working staff attorney for an art museum and a very private person, the last thing she wants to do when she gets home from work is entertain. Her idea of a perfect start to the weekend is a quiet evening at the movies, just her and Greg. It seems an irreconcilable difference. Greg wants 52 dinner parties a year. Emily wants zero. Greg says that Emily should make more of an effort. He accuses her of being antisocial. "I am social," she says. "I love you. I love my family. I love my close friends. I just don't love dinner parties. People don't really relate at those parties. They just socialize. You're lucky because I devote all my energy to you. You spread yours around to everyone." But Emily soon backs off, partly because she hates fighting, but also because she doubts herself. "Maybe I am antisocial," she thinks. "Maybe there is something wrong with me." Whenever she and Greg argue about this, she's flooded with childhood memories. How school was tougher for her than for her emotionally hardier younger sister. How she seemed to worry more than other people did about social issues, like how to say no when someone asked her to get together after school and she preferred to stay home. Emily had plenty of friends. She's always had a talent for friendship, but she never traveled in packs. Emily has suggested a compromise. What if Greg gives his dinner parties whenever she's out of town visiting her sister? But Greg doesn't want to host dinners by himself. He loves Emily and wants to be with her, and so does everyone else once they get to know her. So why does Emily withdraw? This question, for Greg, is more than mere pique. Being alone for him is a kind of kryptonite. It makes him feel weak. He had looked forward to a married life of shared adventures. He'd imagined being part of a couple at the center of things. And he'd never admitted it to himself. But for him, being married meant never having to be by himself. But now Emily is saying that he should socialize without her. He feels as if she's backing out of a fundamental part of their marriage contract. And he believes that something is indeed wrong with his wife. Is something wrong with me? It's not surprising that Emily asks herself this question, or that Greg aims this charge at her. Probably the most common and damaging misunderstanding about personality type is that introverts are antisocial and extroverts are prosocial. But as we've seen, neither formulation is correct. Introverts and extroverts are differently social. What psychologists call the need for intimacy is present in introverts and extroverts alike. In fact, people who value intimacy highly don't tend to be, as the noted psychologist David Buss puts it, the loud, outgoing, life-of-the-party extrovert. They are more likely to be someone with a select group of close friends who prefers sincere and meaningful conversations over wild parties. They are more likely to be someone like Emily. Conversely, extroverts do not necessarily seek closeness from their socializing. Extroverts seem to need people as a forum to fill needs for social impact, just as a general needs soldiers to fill his or her need to lead, the psychologist William Graziano told me. When extroverts show up at a party, everyone knows they are present. Your degree of extroversion seems to influence how many friends you have, in other words, but not how good a friend you are. In a study of 132 college students at Humboldt University in Berlin, the psychologists Jens Aspendorf and Susan Wilpers set out to understand the effect of different personality traits on students' relationships with their peers and families. They focused on the so-called Big Five traits: introversion, extroversion, agreeableness, openness to experience, conscientiousness, and emotional stability. Many personality psychologists believe that human personality can be boiled down to these five characteristics. Aspendorf and Wilpers predicted that the extroverted students would have an easier time striking up new friendships than the introverts. And this was indeed the case. But if the introverts were truly antisocial and extroverts prosocial, then you'd suppose that the students with the most harmonious relationships would also be highest in extroversion, and this was not the case at all. Instead, the students whose relationships were freest of conflict had high scores for agreeableness. Agreeable people are warm, supportive, and loving. Personality psychologists have found that if you sit them down in front of a computer screen of words, they focus longer than others do on words like caring, console, and help, and a shorter time on words like abduct, assault, and harass. Introverts and extroverts are equally likely to be agreeable. There is no correlation between extroversion and agreeableness. This explains why some extroverts love the stimulation of socializing, but don't get along particularly well with those closest to them. It also helps explain why some introverts, like Emily, whose talent for friendship suggests that she's a highly agreeable type herself, lavish attention on their family and close friends, but dislike small talk. So when Greg labels Emily antisocial, he's off base. Emily nurtures her marriage in just the way that you'd expect an agreeable introvert to do, making Greg the center of her social universe. Except when she doesn't. Emily has a demanding job, and sometimes when she gets home at night, she has little energy left. She's always happy to see Greg, but sometimes she'd rather sit next to him reading than go out for dinner or make animated conversation. Simply to be in his company is enough. For Emily, this is perfectly natural. But Greg feels hurt that she makes an effort for her colleagues and not for him. This was a painfully common dynamic in the introvert-extrovert couples I interviewed. The introverts desperately craving downtime and understanding from their partners, the extroverts longing for company and resentful that others seem to benefit from their partners' best selves. It can be hard for extroverts to understand how badly introverts need to recharge at the end of a busy day. We all empathize with a sleep-deprived mate who comes home from work too tired to talk. But it's harder to grasp that social overstimulation can be just as exhausting. It's also hard for introverts to understand just how hurtful their silence can be. I interviewed a woman named Sarah, a bubbly and dynamic high school English teacher married to Bob, an introverted law school dean who spends his days fundraising, then collapses when he gets home. Sarah cried tears of frustration and loneliness as she told me about her marriage. "When he's on the job, he's amazingly engaging," she said. "Everyone tells me that he's so funny and I'm so lucky to be married to him, and I want to throttle them. Every night, as soon as we're done eating, he jumps up and cleans the kitchen. Then he wants to read the paper alone and work on his photography by himself. At around 9, he comes into the bedroom and wants to watch TV and be with me. But he's not really with me even then. He wants me to lay my head on his shoulder while we stare at the TV. It's a grown-up version of parallel play." Sarah is trying to convince Bob to make a career change. "I think we'd have a great life if he had a job where he could sit at the computer all day, but he's consistently fundraising," she says. In couples where the man is introverted and the woman extroverted, as with Sarah and Bob, we often mistake personality conflicts for gender difference, then trot out the conventional wisdom that Mars needs to retreat to his cave while Venus prefers to interact. But whatever the reason for these differences in social needs, whether gender or temperament, what's important is that it's possible to work through them. In The Audacity of Hope, for example, President Obama confides that early in his marriage to Michelle, he was working on his first book and would often spend the evening holed up in my office in the back of our railroad apartment. What I considered normal often left Michelle feeling lonely. He attributes his own style to the demands of writing and to having been raised mostly as an only child, and then says that he and Michelle have learned over the years to meet each other's needs and to see them as legitimate. It can also be hard for introverts and extroverts to understand each other's ways of resolving differences. One of my clients was an immaculately dressed lawyer named Celia. Celia wanted a divorce, but dreaded letting her husband know. She had good reasons for her decision, but anticipated that he would beg her to stay and that she would crumple with guilt. Above all, Celia wanted to deliver her news compassionately. We decided to role-play their discussion, with me acting as her husband. "I want to end this marriage," said Celia. "I mean it this time." "I've been doing everything I can to hold things together," I pleaded. "How can you do this to me?" Celia thought for a minute. "I've spent a lot of time thinking this through, and I believe this is the right decision," she replied in a wooden voice. "What can I do to change your mind?" I asked. "Nothing," said Celia flatly. Feeling for a minute what her husband would feel, I was dumbstruck. She was so rote, so dispassionate. She was about to divorce me. Me, her husband of 11 years. Didn't she care? I asked Celia to try again, this time with emotion in her voice. "I can't," she said. "I can't do it." But she did. "I want to end this marriage," she repeated, her voice choked with sadness. She began to weep uncontrollably. Celia's problem was not lack of feeling. It was how to show her emotions without losing control. Reaching for a tissue, she quickly gathered herself and went back into crisp, dispassionate lawyer mode. These were the two gears to which she had ready access: overwhelming feelings or detached self-possession. I tell you Celia's story because in many ways she's a lot like Emily and many introverts I've interviewed. Emily is talking to Greg about dinner parties, not divorce, but her communication style echoes Celia's. When she and Greg disagree, her voice gets quiet and flat, her manner slightly distant. What she's trying to do is minimize aggression. Emily is uncomfortable with anger, but she appears to be receding emotionally. Meanwhile, Greg does just the opposite, raising his voice and sounding belligerent as he gets ever more engaged in working out their problem. The more Emily seems to withdraw, the more alone, then hurt, then enraged Greg becomes. The angrier he gets, the more hurt and distaste Emily feels, and the deeper she retreats. Pretty soon they're locked in a destructive cycle from which they can't escape, partly because both spouses believe they're arguing in an appropriate manner. This dynamic shouldn't surprise anyone familiar with the relationship between personality and conflict resolution style. Just as men and women often have different ways of resolving conflict, so do introverts and extroverts. Studies suggest that the former tend to be conflict avoiders, while the latter are confrontive copers, at ease with an upfront, even argumentative style of disagreement. These are diametrically opposite approaches, so they're bound to create friction. If Emily didn't mind conflict so much, she might not react so strongly to Greg's head-on approach. If Greg were milder-mannered, he might appreciate Emily's attempt to keep a lid on things. When people have compatible styles of conflict, a disagreement can be an occasion for each partner to affirm the other's point of view. But Greg and Emily seem to understand each other a little less each time they argue in a way that the other disapproves of. Do they also like each other a little less, at least for the duration of the fight? An illuminating study by the psychologist William Graziano suggests that the answer to this question might be yes. Graziano divided a group of 61 male students into teams to play a simulated football game. Half the participants were assigned to a cooperative game in which they were told, "Football is useful to us because to be successful in football, team members have to work well together." The other half were assigned to a game emphasizing competition between teams. Each student was then shown slides and fabricated biographical information about his teammates and his competitors on the other team, and asked to rate how he felt about the other players. The differences between introverts and extroverts were remarkable. The introverts assigned to the cooperative game rated all players, not just their competitors, but also their teammates, more positively than the introverts who played the competitive game. The extroverts did just the opposite. They rated all players more positively when they played the competitive version of the game. These findings suggest something very important. Introverts like people they meet in friendly contexts. Extroverts prefer those they compete with. A very different study, in which robots interacted with stroke patients during physical rehabilitation exercises, yielded strikingly similar